Voices on Climate Justice. Audio reports on struggles for environmental justice. Interviews produced for broadcast on campus community radio stations globally, featuring voices from around the world engaged in frontline environmental struggles and key activists in international campaigns for climate justice. In this report, we will hear an interview with Ben Paulus, writer, photographer, and Mohawk activist from Six Nations, who works with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Paulus speaks on the struggle of Indigenous communities in Alberta against the environmentally destructive, corporate-driven tar sands industry. Ongoing tar sands production threatens over 65,000 square kilometers of forested lands, an expansion that will destroy some of Canada's boreal forest, the world's largest terrestrial carbon storehouse and home to the largest forest wetlands ecosystem left on the planet. In face of growing tar sands production, Indigenous communities are being surrounded, like Fort Chipewyan, downstream on the Athabasca River, and facing alarming cancer rates. Now, we will hear Ben Paulus on the tar sands. Okay, well, first of all, if you could just introduce yourself and speak briefly about the Indigenous Environmental Network and the work that you do.
Yeah, my name is Ben Paulus. I work with the Indigenous Environmental Network, and our organization works across Canada and the United States to support Indigenous communities who are basically trying to fight for their rights, trying to enact, you know, their basic self-determination and sovereignty, and in most cases trying to stop, you know, destructive projects from taking place in their communities that will have negative effects on their cultures.
In Canada, Indigenous communities are, First Nations communities are often at the forefront of environmental struggles. Your presentation today at Cochabamba Plus One conference here in Montreal focused on the tar sands. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you could speak to, first and foremost, the impacts of the tar sands on Indigenous communities where you've spent a lot of time.
Sure. I mean, there's so many ways to break down the tar sands. You know, one of the big things that everybody always talks about, focuses on, is the climate change aspect. And of course, that's, you know, one of the things that I think we should be worried about as a collective species, is that, you know, this the effects of climate change may, you know, basically derail the ecosystems that, you know, exist around the world. But on a much more local level, you know, there's a lot of native communities who are basically surrounded by these tar sands industries. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who are really bearing the brunt of, you know, the ecological burden coming out of the tar sands. You know, the main impacts there are towards, number one, human health, you know, by people who have been forced to drink the water, eat, you know, potentially contaminated foods, you know, breathe in the air that's coming out of these plants. We're seeing incredible increases in rates of cancer, other autoimmune diseases, as well as respiratory illnesses in a lot of these communities. The other big issue, of course, is the contamination and disappearance of the water. The water, of course, is being used up in incredible amounts by a lot of these tar sands industries. They're just sucking it right up. And the stuff that, you know, they're sucking up, they're exposing to, you know, tons of contaminants, a lot of toxic materials, toxic minerals. And, you know, a lot of that is actually leaking back into the Athabasca River and ending up, you know, traveling alongside a number of Native communities, especially alongside Fort Chip. And so, you know, there's a lot of concern in a lot of these communities about the health and safety of associated with drinking the water. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with the animals, mm-hmm. which leads to the third point about food sovereignty. Mm-hmm. A lot of these communities are traditionally very dependent on traditional sources of food, everything from hunting, trapping, fishing. You have things like, you know, of course, moose, rabbit, beaver, and of lots of fish support, you know, the basic diets of a lot of these communities. And people are basically concerned today that, you know, any of these food sources could be putting their lives in jeopardy. They don't really know what kind of contaminants are being found in these animals. The only sort of credible reports that have come out have sort of shown that, you know, they should really be cautious and, you know, can't really trust any of the meats that they're eating. Which is an incredible situation, because, you know, these are communities that are very remote, you know, have lived traditional lifestyles since time immemorial, and are now being told, well, you know, maybe you should buy bottled water instead of drinking, you know, this water in one of the most remote parts of Canada that, you know, the treaties, you know, basically guaranteed would be accessible to them forever. And so, you know, for us, the other big point is that, you know, at the end of the day, this comes down to an Aboriginal rights, a treaty rights issue. Mm-hmm. You know, these basic treaties were signed, you know, by Canadian governments, by British governments, by other governments with First Nations across the country, you know, for the right of, you know, non-Indigenous people to actually live on this land and have access to, you know, any of the resources. And then they, on the other hand, they guaranteed First Nations their perpetual rights to remain on the land, to have access to things like water, animals, and other resources that, you know, they needed for their culture, for their basic survival. And today we're in the situation where, you know, the government is basically neglecting these treaties, is basically saying, you know, we aren't going to follow these anymore, which is basically saying, you know, we're not going to follow our own laws, we're not going to follow international law. And, you know, it kind of puts Canada in the position of being this kind of criminal on this level. The other sort of big right and big treaty part of this being denied is the right of communities to free, prior, and informed consent. And, you know, this is an part of international law, part of the ILO, part of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, all affirm and uphold this right. But, you know, Canada has again come again and again and said that this goes against their constitution, which is, of course, you know, just complete junk, has been dissected that way by, you know, a lot of leading Canadian legal scholars and groups like Amnesty International. So, you know, we have this position where Canada has basically stood up and said, you know, we're going to stand up and defend the rights of these polluters, and doesn't really matter what you, native people of land, have to say or do about this, because, you know, we're going to stand there and we're going to support them. And what that's meant is that, you know, of course we have these you know, humongous concerns and humongous problems going on in Aboriginal communities. At an international level, it's also meant that Canada has been, you know, one of the countries standing almost alone to oppose any of the agreements coming out of the UN climate change negotiations. And so as a result of Canada's, you know, unwavering support for the tar sands and you know, all the industries tied up there, you know, we have the threat of, you know, all these other countries being impacted by our own emissions, because Canada won't even sign on to agreement that forces other countries to reduce their own emissions because they're afraid of looking bad. And so these are some of the real threats that are put into place by the tar sands.
You visited the tar sands and the community's impact that you spoke about. Can you maybe describe what you saw? In your presentation, you showed a photo of a massive, essentially toxic lake contaminated by the tar sands process. Can you describe what this looks like on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, we can talk a lot about the tar sands and throw out, you know, incredible statistics about it being, you know, the largest project on Earth, the biggest single point of emissions of carbon dioxide in all of Canada. But once you really get there on the land is when you really realize the incredible scope and the incredible just really scary reality of the situation. Being there on the ground, you know, my first experience was driving up from Edmonton to Fort MacKay, about 4 or 5 hours north of Edmonton. And we got into Fort MacKay, and it's a community that's completely surrounded by a lot of these tar sands industries. And as you're driving along there, you know, you see all the smoke kind of billowing out from stacks on the side of the road. I started to feel sick almost immediately, which is apparently a pretty common reaction there. A lot of people start, you know, get headaches, and, you know, sort of feel nauseous. You get close to these industries. We got to town into Fort MacKay, and I talked with one of the nurses there, and she was saying that, you know, there's an entire generation of kids being born this day. Almost all of them have respiratory illnesses. And there's a lot of times in the community where, just, you know, because of the way the wind is blowing, you know, if it's blowing the emissions over the community, you know, pretty much everybody will be sick that day. People can't get out of bed. People feel nauseous. People, you know, it's just not kind of unbearable situation to imagine on a daily basis that, you know, people are being, you know, exposed to this here in Canada. And I had an opportunity to go out with one of the counselors of the community, one of the band counselors, and his family had recently come across a tailings pond in the community's traditional trap lines. And so we went out on four-wheelers and went to visit the site, and I wanted to grab some photos and then actually see it for myself. And it completely blew me away, because I thought at first when we showed up there and some of the photos they had taken, it looked like a lake. It looked like, you know, there was this lake and maybe they were dumping toxic sludge into it. What we actually saw was that it was not actually a lake. It was actually a tailings pond. Basically, it was the toxic effluents just being dumped straight onto the land at a volume that had produced a lake about a size of 5 kilometers by 1 kilometer at this point, completely covering up, you know, what would have been pristine, you know, boreal forest before that. And it was just completely unbelievable. We saw tracks of deer, of moose, beaver, fox, rabbit, all going in and having access to the water. There was no, you know, physical barriers like fences to keep any of the animals out. There was no sound cannons like you see in other parts of the tar sands to scare away any of the birds. There was dams of muskrat and beaver on, you know, creeks running into this and attached to this body of water. And it was just completely incredible to imagine that, you know, these animals were all gaining access to this water, but maybe this water was also mixing with other water streams in the area. And when we went back to the community, we talked with a number of trappers and even, you know, people who worked in the industries, and they all confessed that, you know, they started developing rashes all over their body. They called it the muskeg rash, you know, basically just from having contact with any of the water, you know, they would develop these kind of incredible rashes all over their body. And nobody really knew, you know, what was going on. And the other sort of memory that kind of stood out for me, apart from flying over the tar sands and being witness to the devastation from above, was getting out of the car beside, I think it was the Syncrude factory. And, you know, you're surrounded on both sides by these incredible machines. They have machines there that are, you know, about 2 to 5 stories tall that just sort of crawl across the earth and just sort of scrape the earth and, you know, remove it so that they can gain access to the oil that's kind of mixed in with the earth and with the clay. And, you know, so you can imagine these humongous, just massive machines just rumbling across the ground. You know, the earth is kind of shaking a little bit. And then on the other side, you've got these tailings ponds, these humongous tailings ponds, which are completely toxic. And so they've been, the government has forced the industries to put sound cannons and mannequins in the middle of these ponds all over the place so that birds won't land there. And I think many people remember the sort of uproar over the fact that, you know, a few thousand birds landed in one of these tailings ponds the past number of years ago, and all the birds basically died because they got completely covered with oil and other toxic contaminants and basically died right away, and the company was fined. So you have these sound cannons going off, and it's just a sound of boom, you know, big explosion one after another, boom, and then, you know, at the same time you've got the earth rumbling. It really feels like you're in the middle of a war zone. You're in the middle of like a war with Mother Earth, you could even say.
You have been listening to an interview with Ben Paulus, writer, photographer, and Mohawk activist from Six Nations, who works with the Indigenous Environmental Network. For more information on the Indigenous Environmental Network, visit www.ienearth.org. This interview was recorded and produced for the Voices on Climate Justice series, for broadcast on campus community radio stations globally, by Stefan Christoph. Music for this series provided by DJ Moonstar of Public Transit Records, Canada.